Okay.
Okay, you're good to go.
Okay, thank you. The Battle of Cold Harbor was fought from May 31st to June 12th, 1864. Some of the most significant fighting occurred on June the 3rd. It was one of the final battles of the Union overland and the Confederate overland campaign, and is remembered as one of America's bloodiest and most lopsided battles. Thousands of Union soldiers were killed or wounded in a hopeless frontal assault against the fortified positions of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. The Bull Run and Civil War Roundtable is fortunate to have a prominent speaker on the subject to visit us tonight. Mr. Robert Burt, as he's called, Dunkerley, is a historian, award-winning author, and speaker who is actively involved in historic preservation and research. He holds a degree in history from St. Vincent College and a master's degree in historic preservation from Middle Tennessee State. He has worked at 9 historic sites, including Kings Mountain National Military Park in South Carolina and Appomattox Battlefield Park. He's written 7 books and over 20 articles, and some of his books are here with us tonight. His research includes archaeology, colonial life, military history, and historic commemoration. He has visited over 400 battlefields and conducted over 700 historic sites tours worldwide. Burt is currently a National Park Ranger at the Richmond National Battlefield Park, and when he's not reading or writing, he enjoys hiking, camping, and photography. Let's meet and give a big hand to Mr. Burt Dunkerley.
Everybody hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me tonight. I very much appreciate it. And I send greetings from the Richmond Civil War Roundtable, of which I am vice president.
All right.
And I really admire the good work you do with preservation. I think it's groups like ours that make the difference. So keep it up. What I'd like to do is talk about Cold Harbor and address some of the myths that are out there. There's probably some stories and things that you've heard. I'm gonna ruin your night and hopefully shatter some myths and try to put this battle into its context. That's how I wanna start out here. See if I can figure this out. All right, there we go.
No turning back.
Yeah. I've already broken the rule.
Had some hot babes there, too. Yeah.
Richmond that's bread rice.
Yeah.
It's, come on. Stay.
You want me to do it?
Yeah. Hey. All right, thanks. 1864, another spring, country still at war, and by this point, the war has really become grueling for both sides. On the Confederate side, we've had bread riots, we've had food riots in several cities, not just Richmond, Mobile, Atlanta, several towns in North Carolina and Georgia, Atlanta. There's a lot of unrest. In the spring of 1864, the Confederate Congress has adopted a new draft law. We're now taking males from 16 to 50. And it's pretty hard to get out of it, unless you're well connected. In North Carolina, there's such a strong peace movement that there is someone running for governor in North Carolina on a peace platform. And he is promising to pull North Carolina out of the war and secede from the Confederacy. Imagine that. In the Midwest, On the northern side, there's also a lot of unrest. Places like Ohio and Indiana, there's a lot of anti-war sentiment. The draft was never as invasive in the North as it was in the South, but there have been draft riots in New York and other places. A lot of you probably know that. And 1864 is also an election year. And we all know what election years are like. The politics are going to be brutal. And as the spring of 1864 unfolds, it becomes pretty clear to both sides that the Confederacy is counting on Lincoln not getting reelected. That's what they're pinning their hopes on. And they don't need to do a lot to achieve that. What they need to achieve is stalemate. Stalemate is good enough. Because if the Northern public does not see clear-cut victories, if they see more failures on the battlefield, if they see more bickering at army commands, if they see long casualty lists, that will do it. So the Confederacy, the Confederate commanders know what they have to achieve. So do Union commanders. Good. Next one, please. New figure coming to Virginia, General Grant. He's been very successful in the West. Grant is elevated to command all of the Union armies, the first person to hold the rank of lieutenant general since George Washington. And Grant has a lot of expectations attached to him. And most of you probably know he will not sit in Washington. He will join the Union army in the field and accompany the Army of the Potomac on the spring campaign. Grant, 41 years old at the time, and he is going to be the driving force behind what happens in what we call the Overland Campaign. But Grant has a larger strategy, and Grant's approach is going to finally use all of the North's resources in a way that's never quite been done before. Next. Thank you. All right, here we have the country divided up. The strategy for 1864 is to attack the Confederacy simultaneously at several points. And there's several reasons for doing that. Of course, the main effort that we're familiar with is here in Virginia, where the Army of the Potomac will take on the Army of Northern Virginia in central Virginia. There's going to be another Union army that's going to land near Petersburg in a place called Bermuda Hundred, and they're going to attack Petersburg and Richmond from the south. Another Union army is going to move into the Shenandoah Valley, a source of food and supplies for the army here in Virginia. We're going to have another major effort against Atlanta, headed by General Sherman. And Sherman's goal is to move into Georgia and capture Atlanta, an important transportation and industrial center in Georgia. We're also going to have small-scale Union efforts in other places against Mobile, Alabama, in Florida, and along the Carolina coast, and in Arkansas. And all of these things are supposed to happen simultaneously. What that is intended to do is prevent the Confederates from shifting reinforcements from one point to the next, as they could have done in the past. And by this time, the Union Army's war effort, the industry, the economy is really ramped up. Everything's in high gear. Next. We have to talk about this man for just a minute. Everyone knows who this is? George Meade. He's called the old snapping turtle for a reason. Meade was the commander who won probably the only real clear-cut Union victory so far in the Eastern Theater at Gettysburg. However, Meade did not follow up. He did not actively and aggressively pursue the Confederates. He did not attack them on their retreat back into Virginia. And for that, he was severely criticized, both within the Army and by the press and in the public. Even Lincoln was very disappointed that Meade did not follow up. And we can spend a whole nother night discussing why and the reasons for that. Meade has a very prickly personality. And he's called the old snapping turtle. not just because he looks like one. As the campaign in Virginia unfolds in the spring of 1864, of course, the media attention is going to go to the new guy, Grant. And Grant is going to overshadow Meade. Meade is the commander of the Army of the Potomac. Grant is just his boss who happens to be right there with him. That's going to create a lot of tension, as we're going to see. And as things unfold and the Union Army advances, the newspapers are going to give credit to Grant and talk about General Grant. And Meade at one point writes to his wife in Philadelphia, "I hope they remember General Grant when something goes wrong." Okay, next one. And just again, to briefly mention the Union Army's supply and logistical capability, it's incredible. This is an army that can do anything. It can build bridges, it can build railroads, it can move and supply itself with extreme efficiency. And you might say, well, of course, they've got the resources. And that is true. But organizationally, administratively, the Union Army has put a lot of effort into its operations. The internal politics are such that the Union Army is a highly developed logistical and supply system, more than what the Confederates could have and did develop. And it's to the point where using wagons and railroads and steamships, the army is supplied constantly wherever it goes, and empty wagons are not permitted. They're immediately returned for refill, and wagons are assigned to certain units. This thing is worked out at a very detailed level. It's very impressive, and that's going to make what happens here this spring possible. Okay. Yeah, there's the map. Thank you. What we're going to have, and I'm just going to kind of gloss over the beginning phases and concentrate on Cold Harbor, but May 5th, we have the armies coming together and fighting at the Wilderness. And by the way, talk about coordination. Sherman in Georgia steps off on May 6th. The armies will fight an inconclusive battle in the Wilderness, and then they're going to keep moving on. And a lot of times you hear the overland campaign being talked about in terms of earthworks and fortifications, and that is an important part of it. But I would argue that the nonstop nature of combat is another important part of it, this constant maneuvering and fighting. After 2 days in the Wilderness, inconclusive battle, heavy casualties, you know what typically happens after a battle. The two armies come together, they fight, and then what do?
Separate.
Right. Pull back. And each side recuperates, regroups, and they do it again. Grant is not going to do that. And at one point, the Union troops are marching away from the Wilderness battlefield, and they know that their camps are this way, and they take a turn going this way, towards Richmond. And they know that they're not going back to camp, that they're going to go on to another fight. And they cheer General Grant. It's a different mentality now. Grant will send a message to President Lincoln saying, whatever happens, there will be no turning back. And that's the inspiration for the book that myself and my colleagues put together on this. The next fighting will occur at Spotsylvania. And the two armies will continue moving south, the Union Army always breaking contact and trying to get around the Confederates. And because the Confederates have the inside track, they're able to block the way and get there first. They move down to the North Anna. There's a great little park there if you haven't seen that lately. They've expanded it, put in new markers. And then the two armies will move down into Hanover County and end up at a little crossroads called Cold Harbor, named for a tavern that did not serve hot food. Honest. That's where that comes from. And I just want to emphasize, this is going to be 44 days of continued combat. marching and fighting every day. There's no breaks. If you're not fighting, you're marching, and maybe you're doing both. And it's going to take its toll on the men and on the officers. It's going to take a physical toll. It's going to take a mental toll. The Union Army will respond by calling in reinforcements. There are a lot of garrison troops in Washington and Baltimore and across Maryland. They're guarding supply depots. They're in fortifications, guarding cities and railroad stations and so on. Those troops, a lot of them, will be pulled out and sent forward to join the Army in the field. A lot of them are heavy artillery units. They're trained on the big cannons that you see in the forts. They do a little bit of infantry drill because they have a lot of free time, but they are not combat ready in terms of their physical condition and their ability to just blend in with the veterans. But we're going to see a lot of heavy artillery units fighting as infantry to replace the heavy losses. On the Confederate side, they're also pulling in green troops, largely from the Carolinas, especially South Carolina. A lot of South Carolina of artillery, cavalry, and infantry units that are guarding the coast where there's not a lot of activity, they will be pulled up into Virginia. And we're going to have kind of the same thing. These rookies, without combat experience, they're going to be sent in to hold their place in the line. And those Union and Confederate replacement troops will suffer disproportionate casualties. We also have a heavy toll on officers. Confederate Army in Northern Virginia has three corps. What's happened to General Longstreet?
Wounded.
Sure, everybody knows. Yeah. Longstreet is out. He's been wounded at the Wilderness. So we've got Richard Anderson replacing him. General Ewell, commanding the Second Corps, has been ill, and he will be replaced by General Early, who will turn out to be a very good leader, but he's untested at this point at the corps level. And A.P. Hill, the Third Corps commander, has also been ill and at times incapacitated. And so, and even Lee has been ill at times. The Confederate Army at the corps commander level is not functioning as well as it normally does. Corps commander is a very crucial role in the Army. You command a third of the Army, about 30,000 men. You have a lot of new corps commanders coming in, a lot of commanders who are under the weather, not up to the task. That's going to affect the Confederate Army's ability to function and react as quickly as it, not as quickly as it's used to doing. On the Union side, we've got several corps commanders who are also not up to par. Hancock, probably one of the best Union Corps commanders, was wounded at Gettysburg, and that wound will affect him throughout this campaign. He's not 100%. We've got some new Corps commanders, like G.K. Warren, who is struggling to keep up with things. We've got General Burnside, who's been up and down, as you all know. So at the Corps commander level, there are a lot of problems in both armies, and that's going to become apparent as this unfolds. Next, please. The campaign is grueling, and here's what one officer, Corporal William Taylor, 110th Pennsylvania, wrote, talking about the constant marching and fighting from the Wilderness through Spotsylvania. "You could not understand it. I do not understand it myself. I doubt if anyone does." Just the taxing on their mental ability and their physical ability, day after day. Another Pennsylvania soldier wrote, "I wish Jefferson Davis and Abraham Lincoln were both as hungry as I am." And a soldier from Connecticut, talking about the Army's arrival at Cold Harbor, "Marching has completely worn us out, and we were so reduced in strength and mental capacity, it was a matter of dispute whether we were living or dead." And, you know, this is, we're now getting into June as the armies approach Cold Harbor. So think about the conditions. marching, carrying your gear with you every day. And the irony of Cold Harbor in June was not lost on these soldiers. One officer wrote, they call it Cold Harbor, but it was Sahara intensified. And they didn't know why it was called Cold Harbor. That's just what it was on the maps. When you think about Cold Harbor, I'm sure most of you think about a massive Union defeat and just futile assaults, charging headlong into earthworks. It's more complicated than that. It always is. If you break it down and look at Cold Harbor, the first day of the battle is a Union success. And that's forgotten. And because of that initial success, Grant is going to follow up with the additional attacks that do fail. So you have to understand the first day to understand everything else. And as Mark mentioned, it is a 12-day battle, 12-day engagement. Manassas, Fredericksburg, Antietam, these are 1 or 2 day battles. Here we have almost 2 weeks of fighting. And we can get into more about why Cold Harbor isn't thought of the same way and remembered like that. But let's move on. This is the Shelton House. It is maybe 5 miles from Cold Harbor. The house is owned by the Shelton family, and it's an old colonial house. Today it's part of the Richmond Battlefield Park, where I work. And the house is in the process of being restored. If you come visit, it's open on the weekends, and you can see the preservation work being done in and around the house. The brick being repaired, the wallpaper being analyzed, and all that stuff. The Union Army is approaching, and just behind the house is a creek, Totopotomy Creek. And the Confederates are on the other side of the creek on high ground as the Union Army approaches, and they surround the house. Edwin Shelton was not home, but his wife Sarah and 4 of their children were. And there's a great account of a Union officer who says that they advised her and the family to leave because there was going to be some fighting, and she very freely gave her opinion of the Union Army and the president. And that's all he says, but you can imagine what her opinion was. The Sheltons take refuge in the basement down here. And over the course of the next 2 days, there's fighting around the house. The house itself is hit 50 times by artillery. And what the Union soldiers do is they will basically barricade the family in the basement for their own protection. They bring mattresses down from the bedrooms, and they set up a comfortable space in the basement for them. And throughout the course of the next 2 days, Union officers will check on the family. One Union officer says that the family didn't have a lot of food, so he shared his hardtack and some of his meat rations with Sarah, and she got some vegetables out of their garden, and they actually ate dinner together, and he called it a desert in the oasis, an oasis in the desert of war. And the point is that by the end of 2 days, they're almost friendly. It's kind of a neat story. And the Union Army will pull out and move towards Cold Harbor after this, but it ends on good terms. What had started out as kind of a tense standoff. So that's a really neat story. And again, if you go to the house, you can learn about that there. This is the end of May. The armies will approach the Cold Harbor Crossroads on June 1st. Next slide. This is probably hard for a lot of you to see, but down here in the lower right corner is the Cold Harbor Crossroads. The day before, on May 31st, Confederate cavalry had guarded that crossroads, and Union cavalry arrived and pushed them out. Jeb Stuart is dead. Confederate cavalry is commanded by Wade Hampton now, who's still learning Corps Command. And they captured a lot of prisoners. A lot of the Confederates who fought around Cold Harbor on May 31st were some of those new South Carolina units. And Grant sees this. He sees we've captured this little crossroads. We've captured a lot of prisoners. And he writes a message to Washington that says, Lee's army is really whipped. I can see it in the prisoners we've taken, and I can see it in the reaction of the Confederate Army, meaning the Confederate Army is not reacting as quickly and as efficiently as it normally would. So the next day, which is June 1st, Union infantry is sent towards Cold Harbor, and that evening, by the time that they've all arrived and they're all in position, we're going to launch the attack that you see right here. The Confederates have dug a very hasty defensive line. They're not really dug in well. And about 6 o'clock on the evening of June 1st, the Union Army will attack the 6th Corps and the 18th Corps. And if you think, what, 18th Corps? Never heard of them. They're part of the Union Army that is down around Bermuda 100.
Right. Army of the James.
Army of the James. And they've kind of had a very mixed career up until this point. They've been up and down the East Coast on the Carolinas. Anyway, the 18th Corps will assist the 6th Corps in attacking. And they break through. They overrun the Confederate defensive line. It's not easy, necessarily. They take casualties. But they do it. One of the units attacking is the 2nd Connecticut Heavy Artillery. And like a lot of regiments, the 2nd Connecticut Heavy Artillery was raised in one county, Litchfield County, Connecticut. And men came from all the little towns in that county. And on June 1st, the 2nd Connecticut Heavy Artillery lost about 300, I forget the exact number, 300 and some men. 140 outright killed. Instantly, we have dozens of widows and children without fathers in Litchfield County. They were assisted by other units, but the 2nd Connecticut really gets credit for the breakthrough on the evening of June 1st. Next slide. And here, I'm sure some of you have been to Cold Harbor. There's only one monument on the battlefield. And it's to them. It's a more modern monument. It was put up in the 90s by descendants of some of those soldiers in Litchfield. Nice monument. It lists the names of all the men who were lost. So now, if you're General Grant, you've had two successive days of fighting around Cold Harbor. You've captured hundreds of prisoners. You pushed the enemy back twice. What do you do next? You attack. You follow up. And this is what General Grant is hoping for. He's hoping that he's finally pushed the Confederate Army to the breaking point. Cold Harbor is 10 miles outside of Richmond. If the Union Army breaks through, if they actually destroy part of the Confederate Army, they could move into Richmond. This might end it. Remember, it's an election year. Grant is very well aware of the political pressure on Lincoln. They need a victory. Out in Georgia, things are going very slowly for Sherman. A lot of the other Union operations have not gone well, like the Red River in Louisiana, in Arkansas, in Florida. A lot of those other operations have not gone well. Valley, yeah. All eyes are on Virginia. Now what Grant has to do is concentrate his army at Cold Harbor because it's still spread out over a wide area. So on the evening of June 1st, orders go out that we're going to send the 2nd Corps and the 5th Corps down towards Cold Harbor and reinforce the 6th and the 18th Corps. And the attack is going to start at dawn, around 5 a.m. on June 2nd. But the problem is, and if you think about it, you know that they should have realized this. Country roads, dirt lanes, there's no road maps, there's no signs, street signs. The idea of moving thousands of soldiers with supply wagons and artillery and horses over this network of country roads is going to take a long time. And not only that, it's June, it's hot, it's humid. The men, when they arrive, will be worn out from marching. So over the course of the evening, Union reinforcements are sent to Cold Harbor, and they march all night. And around 5 o'clock in the morning, they start showing up. So they're not in position to attack, and they're tired. They're not able to attack. And Grant says, okay, we'll postpone the attack until 5 o'clock in the evening. Give everybody time to get ready. By 5 o'clock, it might start cooling off. Well, by 5 o'clock, troops are still filtering in. The column is very strung out. It was just a grueling march. And Grant says, okay, we're going to delay the attack again. Dawn on June 3rd. So what do you think the Confederates have been doing with their time?
Entrenching.
Exactly. With that break in the fighting, the Confederates have been digging furiously. And they've been preparing their defenses very well. And so the key difference between their June 1st defensive line and their June 3rd defensive line is on June 1st, it was hastily dug. Not very deep, no prepared obstacles out in front, no field of fire. On June 3rd, they've had time to properly dig in. They've angled their fortifications to provide what we call enfilade or crossfire at certain points. They put obstacles out in front. They've cleared open areas for visibility. They've had time to properly prepare it. One of the myths that we have about Cold Harbor is, I'm sure most of you have heard this, soldiers pinning their names to their uniforms so that their bodies could be identified. At the park, our official policy is we doubt that happened on a large scale. The source that you see for that is from Horace Porter, officer on Grant's staff. And Porter's writings are always suspect. He tends to exaggerate sometimes, and often he describes things that no one else does. We don't know where he comes up with it, but the point is, and I mean, I'm not going to say I'm an expert, but I've read over 200 accounts, Union accounts of Cold Harbor, and I've only ever seen one common soldier say that soldiers did that. So yes, it happened, but it was not widespread. And I think most of those Union soldiers who got up on June 3rd approached this as any other attack. It's just another day. We're going to make one more attack. That's kind of the sense that I get from reading their letters, is that we're going to make one more attack. We did it at Wilderness. We did it at Spotsylvania. Here we go again. I don't get a sense of doom and gloom. Now some probably did, and some obviously did. There's one Massachusetts account that talks about soldiers doing that, but by and large, no. So I hope that shattered that myth for you. Next slide, please. So here we go. It's dawn on June 3rd. And I also have to mention, remember that situation between Meade and Grant? Meade has become very testy by this point. Because up until now, the Union Army has had casualties and setbacks, but they've advanced this far. They're just outside of Richmond, and the newspapers are crediting Grant. They're ignoring Meade. And remember, after Gettysburg, Meade was criticized for not attacking and not following up. Remember that. There's been a breakdown in communication at Union headquarters. Grant has issued the orders for the attack and left the details up to Meade. Meade has gotten to the point where let Grant make his own orders. Let Grant take care of the details. So no one takes care of the details. And the problem you have now is the individual Union Army Corps commanders are kind of fending for themselves, and some of them try to cooperate, but not all of them do. And their attacks are not properly timed, and they're not properly coordinated to assist each other. So some attacks don't go off at the same time, and they're even using different formations. They're using different deployments for their troops to try to achieve what they hope is the breakthrough. So here we are on June 3rd, about 5 in the morning. We're going to have a massive attack, not as well coordinated as it should have been. In this sector, 3 Union Corps, the 2nd under Hancock, the 6th under Wright, and the 18th under General Baldy Smith, who wasn't really bald. Anyway. And again, there's a lot of myths and misconceptions. As these attacks go forward, the Union troops take heavy casualties, and they encounter tremendous incoming fire from the Confederates. I would say the heaviest fighting took place at this upper end along the 18th Corps front under General Smith. That's kind of the worst of Cold Harbor, and when you read about or think about attacks that just get decimated, that's where it's happening. There are several units from Massachusetts who attack. One soldier talks about how when they went forward, everyone around him went down to the ground, and he thought they'd been ordered to lie down. And when he laid down, he realized everyone around him had been hit. The 12th New Hampshire from Concord, New Hampshire. This is what Colonel Bartlett of the 12th wrote. He talks about Confederate artillery fire coming into them. The iron swept past about 2 rods in front of us. How it crashed and hollowed through those pine trees. For a moment, the regiment quailed and halted. As it did so, I turned and looked at Colonel Barker. I shall never forget the expression that came to his face. His eyes dilated. So just imagine going into that. The 12th New Hampshire will lose half its men. A lot of these units suffer 30-40% casualties, extremely high. They simply go forward as far as they can, and then the men go to the ground. It's just instinct. There is no cover, or very little cover in most places. And once they go to the ground, they start to dig. And they're digging with bayonets and tin cups and whatever they have, bare hands. Most of these attacks will fail within 20 minutes, which leads to the next myth. You often hear that the Union Army suffered 6,000 casualties or 7,000 casualties in 20 minutes. No. Because the fighting is going to continue all day. Within 20 or 30 minutes, the attacks failed in that they couldn't go forward anymore. But there's still fighting going on, and they're still taking casualties. So the Union Army suffered about, we think, about 3,000 to 4,000 casualties all day. All day. Because the men are out there until it gets dark, when they can finally find some better cover. And there are many accounts, because they have no other choice. The soldiers who survive will start to pile up or hide behind their dead comrades and start to throw the dirt over them to build a temporary shelter and start to dig in. So these Union attacks, for the most part, will fail, and the men will just stop wherever they can, as far as they've gone, and they'll dig in. And from that point, they'll just fire back and forth with the Confederates. The Confederates, a lot of them admire their bravery. A soldier from the 4th Alabama wrote, "It was downright murder to kill men in the performance of an act so courageous." General Law, Evander Law, wrote that he had been at Fredericksburg, at Marye's Heights. He'd been at Manassas, the Deep Cut, and he never saw anything like it. He wrote that Union soldiers were hit simultaneously as they came forward. The Confederate fire was so concentrated. And to come back to the 12th New Hampshire, Colonel Barker, who commanded the unit, they're caught out in an open field and suffer tremendous casualties. He would say that if Jesus Christ ordered another assault, he would not obey it. And just to give you an example, the 25th Massachusetts, one of the units in the 18th Corps that's caught in that deadly area, lost 215 of about 300 men. Devastating. Now what's going on back at headquarters? Well, at 7, 2 hours after this starts, Grant will send a message to Meade. The moment it becomes certain that an assault cannot succeed, suspend the offensive. But when one does succeed, push it vigorously, and if necessary, pile in all the troops at the successful point. Well, remember, Meade is thinking, he's under a lot of pressure. He feels slighted, he feels ignored, and he also remembers the criticism after Gettysburg when he did not follow up. And so Meade will make the rounds to his corps commanders around mid-morning and tell them to make another effort. They all tell him that we're stalled, we can't go forward, and Meade will urge all of them to make another assault. And the messages filter down to the front, and no one is assaulting anymore. Some units even refused to make the initial assault. There were some veteran units who looked out across that open area and said, no, we're not going. And they didn't, and there were no consequences. Some officers refused to order the charge, and they suffered no repercussions from that. So you had just a mixture of valiant effort and holding back on the Union side. There was one brief moment of Union success down here in front of General Hancock on the 2nd Corps front. A heavy artillery unit, the 7th New York Heavy Artillery, broke through. They actually broke through and captured the Confederate trenches, but they were too few in number and they had no support, and the Confederates organized a counterattack. And the counterattack came from troops from Maryland and Florida. And I think that's just kind of interesting because you don't hear much about the Floridians or the Maryland troops with the Confederate Army. But they will counterattack and push the New York troops out. So there was a brief moment of success in that one sector, but it could not be capitalized on. And the actual Confederates counterattacked and ran into the same problem. They were out in the open, and the Union troops were now dug in, and the Maryland troops who attack those New Yorkers are decimated and fall back to their original lines. So by evening, after about 13 hours, darkness sets in, and we finally have the fighting stopping. And the Union troops can finally start to consolidate and dig in and get under better shelter. That's June 3rd, and the armies will stay until June 12th. And what you simply have over the next couple of days is the Union troops will continue to dig in and adjust their lines, but the armies experience for the first time trench warfare for an extended time. Wilderness and Spotsylvania, they weren't there for days and days like they are here. Think about being out in the sun, no shelter. The men are living in the trenches. They're eating in the trenches. They're sleeping in the trenches. They've got to relieve themselves in the trenches. You can't stick your head up. To move back and forth, you've got to crouch down. And one Union soldier wrote that they lived like gophers as he looked around and saw everybody tunneling and digging. They'll stretch their blankets and their canvas shelters over the trenches to block the sun. They're all getting sunburned, and of course, there's no good way to get fresh water. It's miserable. After several days, Meade suggests to Grant that we've got to do something for the wounded who are stuck between the lines. And on June 7th, Grant will send a messenger over to the Confederate side to arrange for a truce. And this leads to another controversy. Sorry, there's something in my eye. Lee and Grant go back and forth on the language of the ceasefire. Lee insists on a proper flag of truce coming from the Union Army, and that would signify that they are the loser, that they have lost if they are the ones asking for a flag of truce. The bottom line is, by the time that they agree on a ceasefire, almost all the wounded between the lines are dead. And so they collect as many wounded who are still alive as they can. It's one of the more tragic parts of the battle. Grant quickly realizes that he is not going to break through. And so he is starting to make arrangements to move the army yet again. In the meantime, the army is still digging in and skirmishing with the Confederates. But Grant has sent scouts down to find a way across the James River, looking towards Petersburg. And on June 12th, around 6 o'clock that evening, the Union Army will pull out. They leave just a thin force in front, and they move the entire army down to the James River, where they have built a bridge over a mile long, pontoon bridge, and they have steamships. And between those two methods, they get the entire army across in 2 days, over 100,000 men. 40,000 horses. Again, go back to the logistics and the engineering. It's an incredible effort. Next slide, please. Oh, I got ahead of myself. Some of the Confederate trenches at Cold Harbor, they're still very impressive. And if you come down, you can see great examples of these trenches and how elaborate and well dug they are. And this is a wartime sketch of the Union attacks going forward. Against this. They had artillery right up front, ready and waiting. Next one. And here we are at the James River. Look at how wide that is. And it's a tidal river, so the water level changes every day. And of course, the armies will move on to Petersburg, and you know what happens from there. In looking back at Cold Harbor, one Union officer, General Thomas Hyde, wrote, "It is very interesting to visit the battlefields of the war, but I never heard of anyone who was engaged there express a wish to see Cold Harbor again. Its vast upheavals of earth in fort and rifle pit, in traverse and covered way, may now have yielded to the sun, the rain, and the plow, but it remains the Golgotha of American history, and gladly we turned our backs on it." And I want to again emphasize that tension at Union headquarters, the breakdown of communication between Meade and Grant, and between the Corps commanders and General Meade. At one point, G.K. Warren wrote to Meade, "I hardly know what you expect me to do." That's not good coming from one of your Corps commanders in the midst of a battle. Meade, of course, will lose his temper several times. When General Smith asks for more ammunition because he didn't bring enough, Meade explodes and says, "Well, what the hell did he come at all for?" Also, in looking back on it, the Union commanders, many of them still felt that they did the right thing. They just weren't sure what went wrong. One War Department officials said the outlook warranted the effort. But for the common soldier, this was the perspective. This comes from a soldier who was there talking about Meade and Grant. It was for one of them to order what the other was to do. As the other only did what the first had ordered, many things were ordered which could not be done, and many things were done which ought not to have been ordered. Think about that. So at the end of the day, we've got 44 days of fighting from early May into mid-June when the armies arrive at Petersburg, 35,000 Confederate casualties, 55,000 Union casualties, about 90,000 total casualties. And there are only 10 cities in the country that have a population of 100,000, to put it in perspective. This does not help Lincoln's re-election campaign. Does anyone know what does? There's one
Atlanta.
Atlanta.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's success out west. The fall of Atlanta in September seals the deal for Lincoln. Things are still stalemated in Virginia.
And Cedar Creek.
Cedar Creek.
Mobile.
Yeah. A few other things.
And the torpedoes.
Cold Harbor is not one of the more well-known battlefields. And when most people think about Cold Harbor, they think about one day, June 3rd. But I hope you have seen that what happened on June 1st was important. We have fighting going on for 12 days total. And the way I like to look at battlefields is, Antietam, you've got the Sunken Road, you've got the cornfield. Gettysburg, you've got the Peach Orchard and Devil's Den, and every battlefield has its landmarks. Every battlefield has its key locations that have been broken down and studied, and you can visit and walk through. Cold Harbor has those places. They exist, but they're not well known because the veterans largely wanted to forget it and move on, and they didn't go back. They didn't put up monuments. They didn't create a park there. The park that's there now was created in the 20s, not one of the early battlefield parks. So a lot of the places that could be remembered and memorialized at Cold Harbor are kind of forgotten. But if you dig deep enough, you'll find the stories and amazing places and amazing stories. I just share one of them with you. During that period of stalemate after the initial assault on June 3rd, some Union soldiers saw how close they were to the Confederate lines and started digging a tunnel. And then the Army pulled out before they could finish it. But where does that happen again? Petersburg. And you'll hear about that next month, I think, when my friend Emmanuel comes up. But there's a lot of great stories at Cold Harbor if you just dig a little bit below the surface. Yeah, sorry. Well, I want to thank you for having me. I'd love to answer questions and have some discussion if people have any points to bring up or things that they'd like to ask.
Why, if they postponed it from the attacks from early on June 2nd to June 3rd, weren't there any reconnaissance done that would have showed them the fields of fire had been created and earthworks were up? And
that's a good question. There was some. In some places, some units sort of scouted out how they wanted to go in, but some didn't. It's kind of hit or miss.
Some the veterans in, some versus weren't. The green troops?
Not necessarily. And that also leads to why some veteran units that morning refused to go at all. But it's just some were prepared and some weren't. It was
I wasn't talking
nothing
about the units. I'm wondering why the command. The higher command, if not Grant and Meade, why not Warren, Hancock, and
some of the corps commanders, like Smith. Smith scouts it out, and Smith talks to Warren, Wright. Smith talks to Wright, who's next to him, and says, "Let's try to work together." And Wright doesn't really cooperate. So it was just you didn't have someone overall coordinating this the way Meade should have done. Yeah.
I understand, I think there were a number of Confederate prisoners taken in the Confederate right, almost 1,000, am I right?
I didn't hear the last part.
On the Confederate right, when they broke through, they did capture hundreds of Confederate prisoners.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
You know, Lee's known for his flanking movements and trying to maneuver. For 12 days, did he do anything to try to do any major attempt to flank the Union Army?
Can you back up to that? I didn't mention that. The map, yeah, right here. Up on the upper end of the battlefield around Bethesda Church, when there's that lull in the activity, the Union troops will actually pull back, and those troops will join these troops, and they form a tighter mass, so that they're all together, and Lee will order an attack. It's badly botched, doesn't go well. That's early section up there. But yeah, they do try, but they can't. The Union troops are dug in by then, too.
So it might seem that Grant's idea that this Army in Northern Virginia isn't quite as agile as it was. And Hampton's there, not Stuart.
Right.
Early's there, and A.P. Hill's not really with it. So you've got a lot of issues going on here on both sides. And they really have pretty much beat each other up at this point.
They really have. And that's something a lot of people don't think about. They think, oh, Cold Harbor's an easy Confederate victory. Well, the Confederates managed it kind of poorly. At the upper level.
But better than the Union.
Better than the Union. Yes, sir.
What's the terrain like at Cold Harbor? Is it hilly, wooded?
It is, I don't know if you can really tell, but it's fairly flat. There's some ravines and terrain, largely farmland with patches of woods, sandy soil, pine trees. There's areas that are fairly open.
Looking at the lineup there, I guess you have Pickett in the middle.
Yes.
Two Union corps on the right, three on the left. What's in the middle? There's nothing there. Why wasn't there some coordination there?
The map isn't as it's the best I could find.
They were closer than it showed.
Yeah, Pickett's division was spread. They linked. And on the Union side, Warren stretched his troops really thin to reach down and grab a hold of Smith's flank. Okay. So there are troops filling in, but it's very thin and there's no fighting there.
Isn't it like multiple time periods kind of shown at once?
Yeah.
That's what I'm kind of getting the idea, because I've seen other maps and we've been down there. It's like the Bethesda Church action was actually May 30, and then after that point, they kind of tightened up, as you say.
There's a good bit of maneuver. If we did it day by day, you'd see a lot of movements on the map.
What did the two armies do with 95,000 casualties?
Well, usually, you know, the loser retreats, and the winner who stays behind takes care of the burials. In this case, they're both moving. They would both leave detachments to take care of burials. Burials are very hastily done. You probably, a lot of you have seen that famous photograph.
Yeah, the skulls.
That's taken after the war when they were reinterring the Union dead in the National Cemetery.
It's like a year or two after it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the battlefield burials are very hastily done. And remember, a lot of the trenches that are there today, there are graves in some of those trenches from the fighting.
What about the African Americans who were back in Culpeper and weren't going to go away quickly? How come they didn't bring them down for reinforcements also?
They were here, but they're guarding the wagon train, which is just off the map. So they're here, but they're not engaged. They're using them as, you know, they're just doing non-combat duty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the other complications for me was the fact that Burnside was quasi-independent.
Yes.
At what point of this campaign was that done away with and he came under Meade's command?
Just so everyone knows, the way you determined rank was the date of your commission. And Burnside and Meade were two of the early officers who achieved the rank of general, but Burnside was a general first, I think just a few days. He was commissioned ahead of Meade. And remember, Burnside commanded the whole army at Fredericksburg. Meade was only division commander at Fredericksburg. Well, now Meade is the army commander and Burnside is a corps commander, but the Ninth Corps under Burnside had been out in Tennessee and brought back to Virginia. And you can't have Burnside under Meade because Burnside outranks him. So there's this awkward command structure where Grant issued orders to Meade for the army and orders to Burnside for his corps. That just doesn't work. So they approached Burnside and he voluntarily agreed to serve under Meade. And that happened on May 28th, right before the battle here. But for up until then, like Wilderness and Spotsylvania, it's this very awkward arrangement.
Can I add something to your second Connecticut story, sort of at the end of it? The second in command of the second Connecticut refused to take command after Fred Kellogg and they lost it on the first of June. And Upton recommended a young regular captain by the name of Ranald McKenzie to take charge. And the orders went from there to Meade, to Grant, back to the state of Connecticut. The soldiers voted on it, and Colonel Ranald McKenzie, U.S. volunteers, walked in on the 10th of June, just in time to march away the 2nd Connecticut and march them over the. Well, actually, they took the bridge over the James.
McKenzie will be very prominent in the Appomattox campaign at the end.
Yeah. He had one of the cavalry.
Yeah.
He was a brigadier with the 6th Corps up until January, and then the Army of the James. Smith at that time took over the Army of the James. McKenzie took over the cavalry division, and they assigned it to Sheridan when they got to Petersburg.
And I should have mentioned the 2nd Connecticut is under Upton, who a lot of you probably know Upton from Spotsylvania.
Column attack or something.
Yeah.
On the mule shooting.
And you know both sides are adapting their tactics. Union commanders are struggling to find a way to break through earthworks. So they're trying different formations, like the columns. They're telling men, they're having them charged with loaded rifles, but they're not capped, so they can't be fired, so they don't stop and lose their momentum. They're trying all kinds of experiments, and nothing really works. You just can't charge against earthworks. In the back, yeah. Well, I think, you know, he doesn't know anything at first. And when he finally does, it's something like, we suffered some casualties, we didn't break through. I mean, they don't really report on the real truth. And, you know, Grant will say that he always regretted the attack at Cold Harbor.
The second attack.
But based on his line of thinking and what he thought the situation was, it made sense to attack. The problem was the reality was otherwise.
Well, he also had the experience of Spotsylvania, where Upton made the minor breakthrough on the first day, and he said, oh, well, with one brigade, let's do it with a whole corps.
Yeah.
So here he was saying, let's do it with three corps.
Yeah. Yeah.
What strikes me here is, you know, we have the same kind of Chickamauga Antietam. There's lots of valor back and forth. One side has good strategic leadership that day, the other side doesn't. But the thing that strikes me is the refusal of veteran troops to go in. Was this the first time it really happened in mass? Not the first time it happened, obviously, but when there was a large number of troops who did that?
I honestly don't know.
But I've read where it starts to pick up towards this latter part of the war, because the veterans know what this is all about now. Mm-hmm.
Well, most of the ones that didn't go in,
massive kind of thing.
The ones that didn't go in were all 3-year men who were getting out at the end of June.
Yeah, I know
they weren't going to die 2 weeks before getting out.
There are many places up and down the line where it happened. I know that, is anyone here from Philadelphia? Two regiments from Philadelphia refused to charge.
That's typical. Smart.
And they were veteran troops, and there were no consequences for that. I think the commanders looked the other way. They knew better. Yeah.
It just seems to me one thing to fault Grant with is almost all the wounded out there were in the blue.
Yeah.
And he was willing to sacrifice almost a large portion of his wounded just arguing over protocol. I mean, it makes no sense to me whatsoever.
I think you're right. I mean, everyone knows it's a failure. What are you trying to hide?
Yeah. If he declares the truce, it doesn't change the reality.
Right.
Yeah. How many days did they stay out?
Well, they started I think on the 5th, and they don't finally settle on a truce until the 7th. But the men have been there since the 3rd.
It's unbelievable.
But I would also just throw out, I mean, Lee could have not insisted on protocol and said to take care of these guys. So I think they're both kind of at fault.
Lee is thinking in terms of it was Confederate policy to do everything they could to damage the Union,
yeah,
with the election in mind.
Yeah.
So he wants the publicity of, you asked for the truce, you lost the battle.
I've heard also that Lee only allowed 2 hours when he did agree to a truce, so they still couldn't get all the wounded off. Is that correct?
No, by the time that they finally settled on it, I mean, these messengers are going back and forth. There's no cell phones or anything. By the time that they agreed and the word got back to everybody, I think they only had a few hours of daylight left that day. So they didn't have a lot of time.
Attention, please. The library will be closing in about half an hour at 9 o'clock. If you need to make arrangements for a ride home, please do so now. If you need to apply for a library card, please go.
Can I get a ride
home? If you want a library card.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Cole Harbor was 10 miles from Richmond?
Yeah.
Exactly. Where is it?
It's on the east side of Richmond.
Mechanicsville?
Mechanicsville.
Yeah, the Gainesville.
Near Gainesville.
Gainesville. Near the
first Cole Harbor. It's east of Gainesville.
Yeah. Speaking of the truce, then there's this interesting situation where some North Carolinian troops were captured during the truce.
Yes.
And Grant realized that they had been captured illegally, and he sent them back.
Yes. They accidentally wandered too far and were taken prisoner, but because it was during that truce period, right, they really shouldn't have been captured.
So
they were returned back to the Confederate Army.
It happens all the time.
Play fair. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, just the thought of guys sitting out in that hot sun for 4 days or wound must have been just I don't know how they could have taken the moaning and the groaning.
I know.
Unbelievable. Everybody drive safely.